welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome, everybody, to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library. I am Evelyn, Reader Services Librarian, and today we have a very special author coming from across the pond. I am so excited to be speaking to her. Her name is Claire Whitfield. Claire is a UK-based writer living in a suburb where the main cultural landmark is a home store Starbucks combo. Are you in a small town, Claire? Where are you?
Yeah. I come from London originally, but about 16 years ago now, moved down because of work to Southampton. So that is like, if you think of the UK on a map, it's like right in the middle, right at the very bottom. And the only thing that I think it's famous for is where the Titanic left.
I know that. Okay. So before you were an author, first of all, this is Claire Whitfield. She's the author of People of Abandoned Character. Wonderful book. We will get into that in a minute. Before you became a writer, what else did you do?
Oh God, everything. I think it's one of the things, isn't it? Like you have to sort of follow your destiny and sort of trip over quite a few things before you kind of find what it is you really want to do. And I was definitely one of those people who had no idea, or still don't, all through my life what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to work with words, but I trained to be a dancer originally. I have worked in publishing, in editorial. I then worked in internet, like content. I then worked in marketing. I've worked in buying, so quite corporate, you know, commodity buying. I've worked in sourcing, I've worked in procurement, and that's where I am now. I work in government procurement for a housing association. And then obviously I write as well. So best of both worlds.
That's so great. Okay, so People of Abandoned Character is your debut novel.
Yeah.
And why don't you tell us all about it? I don't want to give anything away. So you tell the audience what the book is about.
Okay, so it's 1885, and our protagonist is Susanna Chapman. She is about 27 and she lives with her grandmother, and you know, it's 1888 in the UK and life is not very equal. There's no welfare. You know, the best thing a woman can do at the time to secure her economic destiny is to marry someone, you know, that is basically your prospects. And she doesn't have an affluent background. She actually only has one living relative. So interestingly, the big opportunity for her is that a few years before, obviously, there's been Florence Nightingale. So like it's at the beginning of, or in the middle really, of the nursing reforms, when nursing became a profession. So she jumps on this ship, if you like, and gets a career along with, you know, a lot of other pioneering women at the time when this started to become a professional trade. So it was a route to independence. So she becomes a nurse in the East End of London, which is horrifically violent, poverty stricken. It's where all the industry is. It's where all the docks are. So it's quite a sort of dark, crime ridden place. And long story short, she's struggling with her profession. It's really hard work. She's really burnt out, I think. And she's grieving over a personal loss. And she is love bombed effectively by this wealthy but younger man, a doctor at the hospital. So she takes the plunge. She's in love. She thinks it's brilliant. You know, she never thought this would happen to her. And she marries this wonderful man who she thinks adores her. But as soon as that happens, his interest seems to wane. She has to live with his housekeeper. He's from a better class than her. She's older and she becomes extremely isolated. And what she doesn't realize is she's kind of swapped out this independence she had, albeit dangerous and hard work, for this kind of captivity. And at the same time, there is a murderer who starts mutilating women, vulnerable women in the East End. And he goes on to become who is known as Jack the Ripper. But she worries that her husband is always absent or returning home with strange marks or blood on his clothes. And she starts to think he has the opportunity, if not the temperament, to be that person. So what does she do?
Let me tell you, it is so good. It is so descriptive and riveting, and I just love it. I'm like absolutely loving this book. I'm also reading and listening to the audiobook, which I have to say the audiobook is fabulous. The narrator is so good, and it's wonderful. What gave you the idea to write this novel?
Well, that's a funny question, because if you'd have told me that I would choose like Jack the Ripper to sort of, it's not about Jack the Ripper, but it is. So he's kind of like this ominous presence throughout the whole thing. But if you told me I'd do that, I'd have been like, no, absolutely not. Because that's, you know, that's like one, it's the garden variety of serial killers. And as a former, you know, teenage sort of gothy, like serial killer buff, I would have been like, there's millions of serial killers to write about. And also it was quite a well sort of trodden path. And as a debut author, it's quite a big thing to take on. Mm-hmm. The idea came from a writing workshop where, you know, it's like an adult education center. And we'd go there in the evening and do writing exercises. And one of the exercises, the teacher had brought in actual newspaper clippings from 1888, like of the first murder they thought was later identified as Jack the Ripper. In the early days, they started to call him, they thought it was Leather Apron. So there was a lot of talk.
Leather Apron was butchers. Is that what it, like actual meat butchers or?
No, Leather Apron was another guy called John Pizer, who ended up just being a bit of a reprobate, really. But early doors, because he was known to be quite hostile and violent with prostitutes, they thought he was a good contender. And it took him a long time to find him. But in the newspaper, and we were told you have to write about the murder, but you can't write about it from the perspective of being a victim. And you can't write about it from the perspective of being a policeman. So I thought I picked the next obvious one. And it's funny how people's brains work, isn't it? Like you think, oh, I'm going to be really obvious here. I'll pick, you know, got to be married, maybe high chance. I'll pick his wife. Mm. And everyone did it. And then we read them out. And when I read mine out, everyone was like, oh, that's a really good idea. And I didn't really think about it. But when I did a master's degree, like in the evening, years later, we did another exercise. And you know when you're like on the spot and you're like, just go blank. I don't know what to do in this creative exercise. So I just used that again, which is really good. So I used that again and it had the same reaction. So I was like, And then when we had to write a sort of piece for our dissertation about, you know, you had to do a longer piece. It was a creative writing, like master's degree. Mm-hmm. And the tutor said, like, I don't know. He's like, look, let me speak to you plainly. If you did write this novel, he said, it's going to be a sort of love it or hate it scenario, because you're unknown. No one knows you. You know, you don't have any connections to the public industry. You don't have any. Do you know what I mean? It's very much on the outside. And he said, this is a real hook commercially. You know, people might read it. People might turn off because they'd be like, no, Jack the Ripper. But at the same time, it could be quite a good way for you to get in. So that's where it came from, really. And then the more I started to work on it, the more I really liked the character. And I sort of, everyone does, don't they? They sort of fall in love with their main character a little.
Suzanne's a great character.
Yeah, she's funny.
At one point, I'm like, is she an unreliable narrator? I'm not sure. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that's like gripping, and it's like you really like her, and you're pulling for her. You want her to be right with her notions and everything else, but you're like, maybe not. Maybe she's unreliable. So that's like I said, I'm 3/4 of the way through, and it's the type of book where I want it to end because I want to know what happened, but I don't want it to end because it's so gripping and so interesting. So I think it's just fabulous. I'm really enjoying it. I will be recommending it to all my patrons. So
thank you.
What research did you do?
Research? Oh, blimey. Well, this is a real trap for me because I love a bit of research. I'm quite like sad and geeky and a bit of a hermit. So I think I did fall down the rabbit hole a little bit, but I researched everything. So like if I ever decide to write historical fiction again, I always say to my friends, you have one free slap to bring me to my senses. Do you know what I mean? If I start to say, oh, I'm going to write something about, I don't know, the Crimean War, literally just slap me around the face, because it was really hard and really daunting. But it's so I wanted to bring in the sort of landscape of the politics and the time. So I did a lot of research about, you know, social economics. I did a lot of research about just the country as a whole, where people were politically, where wealth was, you know, the whole class thing. I did a lot of research about fashion. I did a lot of research about housing. Housing was a big one because the house obviously is such a central part of where a Victorian housewife has to be. Mm-hmm. That did endless, the wallpaper, what would the stairs look like? Dinner. Because even if you just do a dinner scene, you're like, and you, it may come out. That's the thing. All that research may come out because it may not be right, but you kind of need it. What cutlery do they wear? What time do they eat? What courses do they eat? You know, it's, do they commute? Do they do this? And it's, I did loads of research, but the bit that I became really addicted to was reading newspapers, mm-hmm. like archives. Love it. It's just the best thing ever. And it was really good for, which sounds really sad, but I recommend if anyone's feeling anxious about like the modern world, that strangely, when you go back to 1888 and you start reading newspapers, it's hysterical because the papers could be written today. The language might be a little bit different. And the people we're meant to sort of dislike might be a different group, or, but it's exactly the same. It is with, and that kind of was a weird, in the same way we haven't progressed very much as a species, it was kind of comforting to know we've been here before, you know?
Right. So with all that research, you don't want to waste it. I guess next book you write, you want to stay in the same time frame?
No, I'm not. I've made life really hard for myself because that appears to be what I do. The next book is set in 1993.
Oh, much more current. Okay.
Yeah. But I did enjoy writing about that era. The Victorian era is really interesting. And I think there's so many parallels to today that it is actually quite interesting.
Yeah, no, I'm enjoying the time frame. I really am. Well, when you write a book that's historical fiction, did you feel like you had total freedom, or did it restrain you because of the actual real characters that were around at that time?
I would say a bit of both. So I would say as a debut author, it actually helped a little bit because there is a structure of time, chronology, you can't tamper with if you're going to be true to historical truth, you know? I mean, you could, obviously it's a book, so you could do what you wanted. You could change history if you wanted, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to, the stuff that I actually wrote down that was in, you know, public knowledge, I wanted that to be as close to what I understood to be true as possible. So that gave me a structure, if you like, to work around. Mm-hmm. On the bad side, you've got a structure you have to work around. So it can be quite tricky because you've got to work in all these points chronologically, and sometimes you're like, oh, how am I going to get from there to there in that time? So it was quite an analytical process, but I really enjoyed it. And I think actually if I would say to anyone who's like daunted by writing a book, maybe sometimes picking something that's based around historical truth can help, because it gives you that to dance around, if you know what I mean.
Nope, that absolutely makes sense to me. No doubt about that. So how long did it take you to write this book?
I would say the first draft I wrote in 2016, and I wrote the whole first draft from May to September. So that's not very long. However, it was awful. And when I, you know, when you like, you read something back the first time and you just think, I hate myself. It's like the worst thing ever. And then I rewrote it about 7 times. And then so 2 years later, because, you know, working full time and rewriting a novel 7 times.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I started sending it out to agents. So 2 years, let's say 2 years, really.
And how long did it take till you found an agent then?
I don't know. I think it was quite a few months. Okay. It was under a year, but quite a few months. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it was published. It was published in London or England in October, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
It was published here on May 1st of 2021.
Yeah, the hardback, and then the paperback is out on 1st July.
Oh, very nice. Okay. So how did the pandemic affect your writing time or whatever it is you were editing or writing, whatever phase you were in?
It didn't really affect that, actually. It's like a lot of writers, you know, or writer types, especially. I'm a massive introvert most of the time. So it was like, oh, you're locked down, be at home. Okay. It actually saved me a lot of time because I wasn't commuting to an office. So I had more time.
Right.
I'd say it was difficult in terms of being a debut author and having a launch because you didn't get to go through any of the milestones publicly, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So I did all the work. I did the structurals. I did all that. But you don't have a launch. You don't do any book signings. You don't go to a party. It just kind of happens in the ether. So that was weird. So
were you able to do a lot of virtual author visits?
Yeah. So I've done a lot of virtual things, and it's really exciting to me. I don't think the novelty will ever wear off, that I can finally talk to other people about my book and like they've read it, and like, because otherwise trying to get my husband to read anything is like, it's never going to happen. So like when you're talking to people and they're talking back to you about your book, it's like,
Your baby, right? It's your baby.
Yeah, it's my baby.
it's wonderful. I really have enjoyed it. So when you do write, are you a planner, or do you just fly by the seat of your pants? You just let whatever happens happen.
I say most of the time I'm a planner, a big old planner, and I get like really bad procrastination disease. You know, you still like, I know I've got to get on with something, but I'll be like, oh, maybe I'll like clean out my sock drawer or, you know.
Rather than write.
Yeah, I think it's the only time I've ever cleaned my oven is when I've had like a deadline looming.
That's funny.
Yeah, and or like, you know, I'll start doing something to the curtains. But I'm definitely a planner. However, it's a bit like driving, you know, like when you first learned to drive, or what I was, I couldn't have the radio on. I had to know exactly where I was going, mirror signal maneuver. And then now you're like looking in the footwell, just like moving down the road.
Are you listening to an audio book that you're so immersed in that you forget that you're driving?
Yeah. And then you get somewhere, you're like, how did I get here? I've got no memory of that journey.
Right.
But I would say I plan a lot. But then when I'm in the moment, if I get an idea or go off on a tangent, I'll let that happen.
Mm-hmm. So this book that you're writing now, do you want to tell us anything about it? Or
I don't know if I can. So I can't tell you the title yet, I don't think. But it's set in the Shetlands in the UK, which is like almost the northerly set of islands off the coast of Scotland. It's right in between Norway and Scotland, so it's a very remote cluster of islands that are quite sparsely populated. And it's about a girl who is 16. She doesn't know much about comes from a very insular cloistered family. Her grandmother's recently died, and her mother is got some issues. So she goes to spend the summer with her aunt, who lives on a remote island in the Shetlands. And not long after she gets there, she finds out that her uncle, who she barely knows, who her aunt is married to, was suspected of being involved in the disappearance of his girlfriend 20 years before.
Okay.
And that's all I can say at the moment.
Well, you got me there. I look forward to that also.
Good.
Sounds great. What do you like to read?
Oh, God. My husband always says I must have some kind of like icy black heart because my bookshelves are really like macabre. So, but I don't find it depressing or sad. So a lot of true crime. I love true crime.
Okay.
A fair amount of like military, like war history books.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff he thinks is really dry, you know, but I love history and facts and truth. And then a lot of like crime fiction, a lot of Victorian historical crime fiction, stuff like that.
Yeah. There's a lot of books out there on Jack the Ripper. I'm sure you read a lot of those, huh?
Yeah, I've read a lot of those, but I'd say I stick to a few that I think are really good.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of books that are quite sensationalist. And when, if you're a bit of a serial killer buff, which I'm sure there's millions of people that are, you read it yourself, and say, that's not right. And then you get to the point where you're really sad. But there's a few really good books out there. So yeah, I've read a lot of Jack the Ripper books.
So Jack the Ripper was never caught. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yep. There's a lot of theories about what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But no. And I think that's part of the appeal, isn't it?
Right.
Because
absolutely. It's part of the appeal. No doubt about that. They don't know exactly what happened to him. Did he leave the country? Was he institutionalized? They don't know where he ended up, but the murders did stop happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's several theories again on that, but like they say that, I know there's one rumor that they always think that he emigrated and that a series of similar murders started happening in Boston, but that's just one theory in millions of theories. But yeah, the murders essentially did cease. So what did happen to him or her or them?
Oh, her. Oh, wow. Who would even think it was a woman, right?
Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah. So I heard there's a Jack the Ripper tour over in London. Did you take
it? Oh, there's loads. Yeah, there's loads. So if you go to Whitechapel or Aldgate, which is that area, literally you can walk around at certain times in the evening and there's multiple tours taking place of clusters of people being shown just around the local area where some of the murder sites might have been or where the police station was, stuff like that. A lot of it's not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So Miller's Court, where the fifth murder took place, which was the most brutal and, you know, operatic, if you like, that's all gone. They'll just take you somewhere that's a similar architecture that still survives. But I did the tour 100%.
Right.
And this is how geeky I am. There's a tour company, I can't remember what they're called, but the guy who wrote the book that I admire the most about Jack the Ripper, he used to run that tour, like work on that tour. So I tried to get on that tour to meet him, but unfortunately he was unwell. But I had a great guide anyway, but it was really good. But yeah, you go around the local area and take in the sights along with other people.
So has that area improved or is it still so seedy?
I think it's a bit like, it is really expensive to buy property there. I mean, you're talking like, it's like most cities, it's like millions and millions of pounds. That being said, there is a lot of poor people still living there. There's still a lot of neglect. So it's really a sign of our times and also a sign of the Victorian times where you've got these places where poor and rich are literally like on like at each other's throats almost. So it is a neglected area. It is still quite, you know, chaotic, but it is a great place. I really, it's got a lot of atmosphere and it's been I suppose some people would say it's been gentrified quite a lot.
Right. So are there still a lot of the old Victorian homes there?
Yes, the architecture is amazing. There's a lot of the old architecture, which is great. The hospital where Susanna works,
right,
that is based on reality, that's still there.
It's still there, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the same hospital where the Elephant Man was living. So, yeah, so it's got a lot of, you know, things in of historical significance that's happened there.
Absolutely. Wow. That sounds fascinating. I got to get myself over there one of these days. So what's the pandemic like over there right now?
Oh, wow. I don't think we've been doing a sterling job.
No, that's too bad. Are you guys vaccinated?
I've had one shot.
Okay.
So we're like in the over 40s group. So we've had our first jab now and we're just waiting for our second.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, I think they've made really good progress on the vaccination program, but it's just the new variants at the moment. So we're mostly not locked down, but there's still like big events can't take place, and like weddings you can only have a limit, and funerals you can only have a limit. So there's still a next stage to go. And we're supposed to be unlocking completely on the 21st of June, and I don't know if that's going to happen.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I hope it will for you guys. Have you been going out at all?
Sorry?
Have you been going out at all?
Not really. Only I live by the sea, so I'm really lucky that, you know, we've got a lot of sort of nature around us. And yeah, when we have been able to go out to like pubs or restaurants, yeah, we have, or gone around to see people. But no, not out a lot.
Still a scary time, but it's starting. Maybe eventually you'll write a book about this time.
Oh God, can you imagine how many stories there's going to be about pandemics now? Yeah.
It's going to be a lot. Well, like right now, there's a book out about the 1918 flu, you know, that with the Spanish flu. So many books written about that. So people will be writing about this pandemic. So what's your writing day like? When do you write?
I'm kind of like, I'm not an early morning person anyway, so, which is good. So I generally work from home anyway for my day job. So I work doing that. And then about 5-ish, I basically just switch over and carry on working till 10. And then I work all the weekends as well. So
wow. You spend a lot of time working, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm going blind. I think that's my problem with my eyesight. Do you know what I mean? That's going to be the thing that goes.
Yeah.
I think I'm going blind.
You write on a computer. You don't handwrite, right?
I would say most of the time I write on a computer, but handwriting is great for ideas or when you're stuck.
Right.
So I'm a big map drawer as well. So I've got like a big notepad of A3 paper. And when I'm really stuck, I'll start to draw like notes and diagrams, and it wouldn't mean anything to anyone else. But that's how
going.
Yeah, definitely. And if I get really nervous of a chapter or I'm intimidated by it, I tend to write like directions. Mm-hmm. Don't know why. It helped me.
So time goes pretty quickly, right? When you have a deadline looming.
Yeah, I think I must be a real masochist, get the right one, because I really enjoy rewriting and I really enjoy editing and rewriting. I'm not the first drafts, and you know, the early days when you're trying to sort of mold some story out of something, I find really hard. I don't think I'm alone though. From what I've learned from speaking to other authors, there's a lot of that, you know. The blank page, the trying to mold the structure and all that stuff is hard. And then once you get that, that's when you can start having fun, because you just rewrite. Yeah.
Do you have an author group that you like talk to and hang out with and send papers and let them critique it?
No, I know a lot of people say it's good and you should. But to be honest, like, I never knew any authors before I started trying to write. It always seemed like really far out of reach, you know. I know a few authors now, like more from sort of like supporting each other on social media and buying each other's books, that sort of thing. It's a very supportive community. I do have some people who like to read for me, Obviously not my husband, because he just doesn't read at all. But no, I don't have an author group. To be honest, I suppose I don't know when I'd fit it in.
Exactly, right. You don't have time. You don't have time. Well, I just want to tell our audience, if you have any interest in Jack the Ripper or just a good character with great scenes, has anybody been interested in making this a movie? Has any come up?
I wish.
I could that see it. I mean, the details are so wonderful, and the atmosphere and the housing and the hospital. I just can picture it. I think it would be a fabulous movie.
Yeah, I think, well, obviously I'm biased, but I think it would be a great movie too.
Yeah.
But I tell you one thing that I do that, like my characters, when I like create the character, for me, I'm quite a visual person. So I have to pick people. This is what I say to my friends, like, you know, you should be nice to me, because otherwise I'll put you in a story and it won't end well. I have to pick people visually who I either know, see, or are famous.
Sure.
And have them as the to visualize it.
Okay, so Suzanne is who and Thomas is who?
Well, I can't say, obviously, I can't say. What's funny is that the people that have read it and then send me messages and like, I saw this person as that person, or this person as that person. But you never know. Maybe that's what I should do. Maybe I should start like sending books to their agents. And
Well, I'm drawing a blank on her name, but the woman, the housekeeper.
Mrs. Wiggs.
Mrs. Wiggs, thank you. Who do you think would be her? She's not the nicest person.
No, she's pretty harsh. And I've got to say, I've based her on a number of people I've worked with.
Oh, okay.
But I'm trying to think, who would be a good Mrs. Wiggs? Because, you know, they've got to be at the right age, haven't they?
Right, right.
I wonder if Sigourney Weaver would be a good Mrs. Wiggs.
Oh, okay, okay. I could see that.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and I just have one question. What are the drops that she's taking?
Oh, laudanum.
I don't know what that is.
It's so basically, before like a lot of drugs were regulated,
mm-hmm.
you could buy anything from either the chemist or like, just like, they weren't even chemists some of the times. They were like drug stores, whatever. Like they'd sell sweets in the same place and cough drops
uh-huh.
or teas or all sorts of things. But laudanum is like an opium sort of drug. So what they would do is you can get it as a powder, I think, and you can either eat it or smoke it. But what she would do is what most people would do was take drops and put it in something like a brandy or anything. And it's like it's an opiate sort of drug. And it was widely available. You just go to the shop and buy it. Mm-hmm. And it was in a lot of children's medicines, not cocaine, but derivatives similar were in a lot of the medicines back then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you just, you know, answer adverts in the paper or go to certain shops and feed your baby and keep you quiet.
Very addicting, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Very addictive.
Yeah, that's what makes me wonder her unreliable narrator status. Like, that. And you did a really good job with that, I have to say. Oh.
Thank you.
Really, really, you're not sure. So once I finish, I'll send you a quick little message and let you know what I think, because I know there's great twists and turns coming and I look forward to that.
Yeah.
But then I don't want it to end. So it's so good. So I thank you so much, Claire, for being here. I loved speaking to you, talking to you about your fabulous book, People of Abandoned Character. The title, why don't we talk about the title? What exactly does the title mean?
So when I was like researching in the newspapers,
mm-hmm.
it was quite a common turn of phrase.
Okay.
So, but it was a kind of like, I think it's great. It really sort of really encapsulates the Victorian snobbery and sort of the sort of passive aggressive nature of what was classed as good manners. It's not great, it's horrible, but I find it amusing. So they would describe a person who was not very nice as a person, you know, a person of abandoned character, or a person who smelled bad would be a person of abandoned hygiene, or a person who was a layabout and, you know, a no-hoper would be a person of abandoned habits, or like a fallen woman or a homosexual would be hinted at as a person of abandoned morals. So it was
that was a term from the 1880s, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it was like a insinuation of things, but I just saw it and thought, do you know what, it completely describes everyone in that book, because like you say about Susanna being unreliable, no one's perfect,
right?
No one is the hero here, and I like that, because I think that's what we need. I no one's perfect, no, everyone has flaws, but you got to live with that and work and like progress.
This was a wonderful interview. Thank you so much. And you know what? When the next one comes out, we'll chat again.
Cool. Brilliant. Thank you for having me.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.